Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I keep making jokes. I'm too old for Leonardo DiCaprio.
You are.
And that's about
that's
it.
True. Like, that's a fact.
My life is basically over.
It's
now.
It's over now. You'll never date Leonardo DiCaprio.
I, to be fair, I think I might be okay with that.
I think you're probably right. There are rumors that he has sex with headphones on.
What?
Yeah, confirmed. That's actually true. I know that on very good authority. With noise cancelling headphones on.
Welcome back to another episode of Girls Know Nothing. Our next guest is an ex-elite athlete who swam for Great Britain and Kenya over a 10-year career. She is a former British champion, a world number one, and the first black woman to ever swim for Great Britain. Her 2019 documentary, Breakfast in Kisumu, which she directed and produced, premiered at renowned film festival, IDFA. Rebecca has also been honoured in Forbes 30 Under 30 Class of 2023 in the Social Impact category. Not only this, she is also the CEO of the 10,000 Interns Foundation, a non-profit that champions underrepresented groups by creating an internship opportunity. Prior to this, she founded and ran NKG, a creative strategy and media agency focused on social change projects. Rebecca also studied fine art at the University of Oxford at Brasenose College. So welcome to the studio, Rebecca.
What an ick. That's a new ick on my list, like headphones during sex. Anyway, tell us about how you became a swimmer.
Okay, we're in. All right. So I grew up being terrified of the water.
Okay.
Which I think is really common in like black communities.
Yeah.
And I mean, that definitely wasn't my experience. So I'm mixed race. My mom's white. My dad was black. And when we moved out to Africa, we lived in Uganda for a while on the shore of Lake Victoria, which is where nice. My tribal family is from. And I used to get in the pool with like a rubber ring and like armbands. And like I used to be like, make my mom hold me. I'd be like, can't let go. And I don't know, one day it just clicked and all of the plastic floaty stuff came off and then that was it. It just felt like home. It's like easier than walking.
And I really? Loved it. It literally just like that?
Just one day. Yeah.
I was going to say, fear of water is not irrational.
No, it's not. And I feel like I'm still like really terrified of the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I have like a lot of reverence for just open water. And I think it's immense and scary and I don't know, like existential. But it is, you know, you have to have a lot of knowledge to have like good water safety. So I think, yeah, it's not irrational at all.
But then, so going from rubber dinghies to then swimming, like as a professional athlete, that's quite a big jump.
Yeah, it wasn't a short journey.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like, so how did that journey like start or come about?
So we moved to Kenya, which is where I grew up and kind of where I'm from. I'm half Kenyan, half British. And I did my first race when I was about 6 years old. It was like, it's very cute. And I think I swam like the 25 meters front crawl and I was just so fast, like a little eel. And I remember going home that day and I like drew my mom this little picture of like a girl in a swimming costume with a medal around her neck. And I was like, this is me when I win the Olympics. And then that was it. And then I just started training and I started training more and we moved to South Africa and I trained even more. And training is like the kind of constant theme.
Yeah, I can imagine.
of the whole thing. And then when I turned 12, 13, my parents were thinking of moving back to Kenya. And there aren't really great facilities there. You know, no indoor pools, no yeah. kind of, you know, infrastructure around big kind of coaching faculties or whatever. And then I came to the UK, went to boarding school here and swam.
Because you became the first black woman to swim for Great Britain. So you literally manifested by that drawing, right? If you believe in that kind of thing.
I certainly don't, but if I did, then yeah, that's what I did.
So what challenges did you face in the world of professional swimming? And like, how did you overcome that, being the first black woman?
I think it was weird having like a mixed heritage and kind of facing that level of scrutiny and also getting that title really young. So I was 16 when I became British champion, 15 when I got my first kind of world number one ranking. God. And then my kind of senior British debut was like later that summer. So I was super, super young. And I think I'd like always understood myself as being mixed race. I grew up in this really kind of like white expat world in Kenya. I didn't have like a really strong connection to my black identity. I didn't really like understand myself through blackness.
Yeah.
Especially like going to boarding school in Devon, like it was such a white area, yeah. you know, like it was so, and also all those tropes around like black people don't swim. And I was always the only black girl on poolside. And so, you know, that title really felt like quite affronting. It was like quite a lot of scrutiny. You know, it was like 16, my body was developing, like there was a lot of, you know, like press and media attention just around what I looked like as opposed to your how ability. Good I was yeah. at what I did.
That's quite a big thing to deal with at the age of 16, because I think at 15, 16 I was in a park playing with the football, but definitely not at a professional level with all that media attention on you. Was that really tough to deal with?
Yeah, it was. And I think for a long time, I didn't really talk about how hard it was, but yeah, it was incredibly hard. I mean, I think when you're competing at that level, like the nerves and the pressure, that's all there already. And to be really good at what you do, especially when it's an individual sport like swimming, like you have to really like block out the noise and you kind of get up behind the block and you just have to kind of forget that everything else exists. And when there was so much noise around my race and, you know, whether I was going to succeed and whether I was going to prove people wrong and whether I could swim against these narratives that were so entrenched in, you know, the world of sport, it became like harder and harder to block that out, you know, and I think it really started to affect my performance.
Do you think that your achievements contributed to an increase in diversity and inclusion in the world of swimming, or?
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. initial quality study award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
It's an interesting question. I mean, it took 10 years after I quit until there was a black woman at the Olympics for Great Britain. And that was Alice Dearing in 2021. Wow. And I retired from professional sport in 2011. So, I mean, how much has it changed as a kind of institution? Like, not that much, I don't think. And when I first quit, I think that, you know, a lot of people wanted me to speak about, you know, what it was like, yeah, or what it meant for me. And I think I felt like I had to have all the answers, you know, and people would ask me, like, why don't black people swim? And I was like, I don't know. You know, I'm like, I'm 17. I don't, you know, I don't even know myself right now. Yeah. And I was still trying to figure out, like, what it all meant. And then, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I guess, I realized that just, like, the value of sharing my experience was probably enough, right? And that, you know, I can't represent for everybody, but
yeah,
I mean, do what I can.
It's a lot to take on. There's a lot of, it's quite a grown-up thing to take on at the age of 17.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't feel particularly grown up. I still don't feel very grown up, but
sorry, neither
do I. I definitely didn't then.
But I was like, when I was doing research for you on, for this episode, you've literally done so much. So, like, after you stopped professionally swimming and, like, kind of moved on from being an elite athlete, you went into being a filmmaker and a writer. So kind of talk me through that transition and how you decided that was the path you wanted to go down.
I'm trying to think about where to start. So when I quit swimming, and I think much like you, I'm like really voracious and kind of intense, and I'm always like, what's the next thing? Like, what's the next hurdle? What's the next moment? And so I kind of, I guess, I dusted off my school books and worked really hard in my last year of school. And I went to Oxford, and I thought that I was going to study politics, and I ended up studying fine art. And I specialized in film, and I loved film. I was really interested in making, and, you know, then I realized my parents weren't really rich enough for me to become an artist. So that that went in the bin. But it took me a long time to come back to kind of creating. And then eventually I did. I made this film, and I kind of, I guess, understood that through writing. And I really wanted to, I don't know, I wanted to be involved in storytelling. I think I probably wanted ownership over my own voice after feeling like I didn't really have that during swimming.
Is that how it shaped your perspective on, like, diversity and representation, like, by wanting to put it through a different form?
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of putting it. I think I've never necessarily thought about it like that, but I really liked being behind the camera for once. I liked having that complete control over, like, how the story was going to be told and what people were going to feel when they heard it or when they experienced it. And I think that that level of control is something I've probably sought a lot after my swimming career, where it felt like, you know, I was in control of nothing.
I can imagine as well, moving on from, like, the politics of being a professional athlete to then moving, I can imagine as well, politics in Oxford is probably not as fun as doing fine art, right?
It was an interesting degree. I mean, art school is kind of mad, obviously. It's just like loads of, you know, self-conscious, like, narcissists, just like all in one place. But, you know, again, I was like the only black person in my year, and, you know, Oxford has its own issues with diversity and representation, as all kind of elite institutions do, as a lot of our, you know, British institutions do. And so, you know, again, it wasn't like a super comfortable space for me at times. It was, you know, it still felt like a kind of struggle to find my place in it.
Your first documentary,
yeah,
Breakfast in Kisumu, and it did receive a lot of recognition. What was your inspiration behind making that documentary?
So, I guess this kind of, like, links into what we were talking about earlier, right? Like, finding some sense of your identity and your heritage. And for me, that was after my father passed away. And he was a, you know, freedom fighter, academic. He was very involved in the resistance against the kind of apartheid regime in South Africa. And so when he died and we buried him in Kenya, it was the first time I'd kind of gone back as an adult. And it was this kind of real awakening and I guess just reckoning with, you know, where I'd come from and how it felt to be back there, especially, you know, being like a light-skinned black woman, and that was a difficult narrative to kind of hold in tension with having grown up in the UK, but having all of this family that I hadn't spent a huge amount of time with. And weirdly, just before he died, I sat with him over breakfast and I recorded this conversation, and I asked him about his life when he was my age and meeting my mother and being in prison and being out of prison. And he didn't know that I was recording him. And then, I know, after he died, I found the voice notes and all the recordings, and I started putting this film together.
There must have been like a part of you that was like, I have to like record this conversation.
It was really serendipitous. Like, I don't know why I did it. I also like don't really do things like that. So it was a very strange thing that I decided to do. But basically I kind of traced his footsteps, and we went to all the places that he talks about. He was exiled from Kenya and went to university in Bulgaria. And so like we filmed in Sofia. Oh, wow. It was crazy. It was nuts.
Yeah, I think that I actually do wish I did that with my granddad, because he had like quite a wild lived experience as well. But I think that there's a general consensus with every mixed race person I know that it's great because you grow up in so many different cultures and you have such a good understanding of so many different things. But like for me, I never felt white enough to be Polish.
Right.
I never felt dark enough to be Asian.
So
and then in each community, it's a little bit like, well, what really are you?
Yeah, you're born very much in between, right? And you kind of end up as this translator between two worlds, but you're not fully a part of either one of them.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I go back to the village in Kenya, the kids will like point at me and they're like, Mzungu, Mzungu, which means like white person, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, who? Like what? I'm like, oh God, me. You know, and it is, it's like the color of my skin changes the way I'm identified in so many different places. Like in the UK, I'm black. When I go to Kenya, I'm like almost white. When I'm in South Africa, I'm like Cape colored. And it's like a really dislocating experience.
I think it's a weird thing that I think every mixed race person will feel. Cause like I get that. If I walk into like a Polish supermarket, they're like, what's this girl doing in here? But then if my cousin, my baby cousin, used to cry at the sight of me because I was so white.
Wow.
And like, so I think I always felt like, oh, where do I
fit
in? And then I guess that's probably like what inspired you to go on and to tell like stories and shine light on these.
Yeah, I think that especially kind of first and second immigration kids, mixed race kids like us, you know, like you don't necessarily have access to that world, right? Like now that my dad's gone, I have to take myself home when I go back to the village. And that's like a weird thing because it's not somewhere I grew up. It's not something that the way I look, you know, easily kind of identifies me as being from. And so you do have to kind of take your own ownership of it and shape it in a way that makes sense to you. There's no like blueprint.
Yeah. Do you feel like you've grown as a person by forcing yourself out of these comfort zones and taking yourself home and trying to learn a bit more about where you've come?
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Initial Quality Study Award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
I'm from in your family.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, the last time I did it, I kind of drove by myself, which felt, I mean, it's not a big deal, but it kind of felt insane. It was this like, okay, this is kind of my life now. I'm going to be making this journey myself. I'm going to be making it with my kids, hopefully one day. And knowing that I can do that, I think is quite powerful.
I mean, even if it doesn't sound like a big thing, it feels like a big thing to you.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's important, right?
Absolutely.
But all of your work seems to really focus on a lot of social impact type things. And could you elaborate a bit more on the mission behind the 10,000 Interns Foundation?
Yes, I can. I talk about this all the time. So we're a charity that champions underrepresented talent. And what that means is that we create programs for young students and graduates from underrepresented communities to gain access to opportunities that they are oftentimes overlooked for or that oftentimes aren't really accessible to them. So we have a program for Black students and graduates, and we have a program for disabled students and graduates as well. And we've been 3 years in the making. We've created 5,000 paid internships so far.
Oh, wow.
So we're already halfway there. And we've had 25,000 young people come through our programs and receive training and development opportunities. It's a really insane job in that it's both amazing and that it's just so full on.
Are the internships in one in a specific thing, or are they like depending on what the person wants to do?
Yeah, so we work with over 700 companies all across the UK, and we represent maybe like 30 sectors. So each intern that applies gets kind of three choices of things that they might want to do. So marketing, advertising, and I don't know, creative and culture. We partner with the Royal Academy, with the NHS, Nike, BBC, Goldman Sachs, Nationwide, Lloyds
Bank,
all the
big ones,
everybody that you can think of. And yeah, it's very, very, as you can imagine, like meaningful and kind of humbling work.
So when you get to the 10,000 mark,
what happens?
What are you going to do? Like, what happens next? Like,
well, then we've solved all the problems of the world and it's over. So no, then, you know, then kind of more impact. I'm thinking about breadth and depth of impact at scale. You know, what does it mean to kind of not be so London-centric? How can we create even more diverse opportunities for people? How do we nurture our alumni community? Are there other underrepresented communities that we can help? You know, I think, yes, we're only solving a very specific problem by creating internship opportunities, but oftentimes it's the first step for somebody in kind of changing the trajectory of their kind of career and broadening their horizons. And so I think that, I mean, everyone kind of remembers their first internship. Did you ever intern anywhere?
I don't think I ever interned anywhere. I literally went straight from sick form straight into government.
Wow.
So I went straight into my first full-time job at 18. But I remember...
That's so hardcore.
That's where the menopause story starts coming. But like, it was quite scary because I didn't feel like I had a safety net. You know, when you're an intern, people are always, I feel like they're a little bit more lenient towards you. Whereas I think,
yeah, you can fail forward. You can kind of just, you know, people don't expect you to know what you're doing, which is like the best learning opportunity, right?
Yeah, I didn't get that. But then it's nice as well when you picked up on the London centric stuff, because, you know, neither of us grew up in London. And I felt like being from a diverse background has its own challenges anywhere in the UK. But I think when you're more London centric, it's just generally more a diverse city anyway. Whereas I came from South Oxfordshire and I probably stuck out like a sore thumb in many ways.
Absolutely.
And then all of the opportunities you tend to find, or like ways to help you get into like certain opportunities, are all London based.
Yeah.
And then other people, especially up north, tend to get forgotten about.
Yeah. Really, really left behind. I mean, I think that's part of like a broader agenda at the moment, but it's something that, yeah, we've got to take very seriously. I mean, my parents live in Gloucestershire and it's very, very specific demographic. And yeah, I can't imagine what it's like kind of growing up there without the level of representation that we have here in London, right? And I think if you can see it, then to some extent you believe that you can be it a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that needs to kind of be extended outside of, you know, where we are right now in metropolitan.
Do you know what? I hear that phrase from so many guests that sit on that sofa and they're like, you can only be what you can see.
Mm.
And it comes from like, you know, so many people feel like they have to walk so other people can run after them.
And you were talking about how your parents live in Gloucester and how all these places you've lived, how do you feel like it shaped your own identity?
I think about this a lot. I think when I was younger and I was growing up, I really wanted that kind of what other children had. They grew up on one street and they had all these friends and they went to the same school their whole life. And there was this sense of kind of continuity and,
yeah,
you know, really physical community that came from that. I moved around all the time. I moved schools like every 2 or 3 years. I moved countries almost as much as that. And so I guess now that I'm older, I think it's given me this amazing sense of cultural literacy and this ability to kind of, you know, imagine the world outside of where we are right now or what I can see around me. And I don't know. I mean, I think what feels important to me now is that every interaction and every conversation, every interaction that I have with people is kind of inherently political and important. And, you know, I don't really have a strong sense of kind of nationalism or identity that's rooted in any one place. It kind of feels like it comes from everywhere.
I think that's one thing that I've never lived abroad, but like having traveled to like home for long stints of time, I felt like that.
Where is home for you?
So my mum's Indonesian. So like I used to spend summer and all of Christmas, like it was basically like almost 2 months in a whole year there.
Oh my God, wow.
So it was a lot, but like, I think it made me, it really opened my eyes. And I think that made me realize how lucky we are sometimes in the UK to have access to the things we have access to and being able to understand how different people live. And I think it makes you less ignorant as a person. I think when you meet somebody that's not like you.
Yeah, I think that's so right. I think that's so right. It's really good to be out of like your echo chamber and to not kind of think that the whole world is created in the same way or that people are having the same kind of experiences.
But I also did have what you said that you wanted when you were younger about growing up on the same street and having the same friends and things. And I actually think, now, maybe it's just because, you know, when you always think the grass is always greener on the other side, because sometimes I think, oh, maybe I would have liked to move to a different country when I was younger and like take those opportunities, because you have a weird, like when you outgrow your friends, if you've had the same friends for the whole time you've been a child all the way to adulthood, you feel like you have to stay with them.
Yeah.
But you don't.
I see that so much, right? People have kind of pulled their, you know, high school or like uni friends kind of into their life. And, you know, I mean, some people are really lucky and those are the people that they're kind of bonded to. But I think for a lot of people, they're in London, which is inherently, you know, a kind of lonely place anyway. And they don't feel that connected to this group of people that they've kind of just inherited and like had for a really long time. And I think if you move around a lot, you end up having this more kind of diverse and eclectic group of people that are from different places and different parts of your life, and you can be different parts of yourself with each of them.
That's why sometimes friendship groups don't mix.
Yes.
Don't always mix your friendship group. One thing I was talking to you about earlier was congratulations on being Forbes 30 under 30.
Thank you.
You don't get any shiny
prizes. No award.
Yeah, no sparkly prizes.
There's no award.
I would feel like I'm that type of person, I would make myself one. Is that really vain? Just to like make myself a trophy.
To be like the only person. It's like, this is my Forbes 30 under 30 award. Yeah, no, we don't get anything apart from obviously a very warm feeling in your heart. No, I'm kidding.
Did you get a warm feeling?
Did I get a warm feeling? I'm thinking about that. I don't know. I think honors lists are kind of complicated. Like we were talking about earlier, I think it's hard to measure your life in these really like discrete chapters and what happens after 30, right? Like,
yeah,
there's no Forbes 40 under 40.
Well, because it's like I was saying to you, I was like, oh my God, but I turned 30 in 2 years. What if I didn't get Forbes 30 under 30?
Panic. Life is over.
I think it actually might be.
It's certainly not over. I think the social impact category is really interesting and important. We've got to build a future that is different to the present that we currently experience, and for so many reasons. And so I think to honor people who are doing things to change the kind of social fabric of our country, the world, you know, the way that the climate interacts with everything else that's going on, you know, that feels really important. And so, yeah, to be in any category, I think that is definitely the one that feels most, yeah, salient to me.
Did it give you any kind of leverage to like make change, or was it just one of those things that you kind of collected on the way around? It makes it sound life is like a Monopoly board. So.
Yeah, gotta catch them all. Did it give me any leverage? You know, I think after I quit swimming and I'd kind of been really visible for quite a long time, I really shied away from that. And I didn't really want to have like a hyper visible job or like a hyper visible personal brand. And then I took the job at 10,000 Interns as CEO, and that kind of changed that, and I had to lean into it a little bit.
Yeah.
And so definitely having platforms and awards and, you know, being honored in Forbes 30 under 30, like, it only serves to kind of strengthen the power that I have to impact change. And so that's the way I have to use it.
I guess as well, if there's other, like when you were saying that whole people make comments about black people don't swim, and then if you were a black swimmer and you see somebody who's done it the same way as if you'd seen a black person make 30 under 30, it kind of, even if you don't actually necessarily do those things yourself, it can say like, if someone else can do it, I can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I was really lucky that my parents kind of raised me to believe that I could do anything that I wanted to and be anything that I wanted to be. And I think that probably freed me from a lot of the kind of gender and racial politics of being black and being a woman. But it didn't stop me from having to face it anyway. And so, yeah, there's a part of me that when I get recognized for things like that, I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, you should feel
like,
proud.
Like, fuck you, yeah.
Even if you, like, this conversation is your sparkly prize. I'm sorry it's not as glamorous as getting a nice little trophy, but like, there are so many things that I wanted to talk to you about, but I think one thing that I really wanted to ask you about was your book. These Black Bones was your debut as an author. Can you tell me about your book and what it is about, essentially?
Yes. So, it comes out next year in June 2024. But I think pre-orders will be ahead of that, so look out for it. These Heavy Black Bones is about coming of age, and it's about race and racism, and it's about my journey through elite sport, why I so badly wanted to be the best, and also why I kind of walked away from it. It's, I guess, a bit of like an offering of freedom to myself. I think I spent a lot of time after I quit, you know, just not being able to kind of interrogate it and not knowing what it all meant. And so writing about it, I think, helped me just to kind of set some of that stuff free, and also, I guess, to acknowledge other people who would also experience similar things.
I think because one criticism I've always got is when you put something that's quite personal out online, everyone's like, well, why are you sharing that if it's personal? And I think it's about taking back your own power.
Yeah.
And about allowing what you want to share with people,
yeah,
be shared, and then being able to keep certain bits for yourself. And I think it's a really powerful way to think and move for yourself. I think that's, if people aren't online or don't have a public facing role, don't necessarily understand that.
It's hard to know like what to give away, right? And what not to, and where's that line. And when I was writing the book, I was really, I didn't think about anyone reading it, because I wanted to be as kind of truthful and as self-effacing and as honest as possible.
Yeah.
And then I was speaking to my agent and my editor the other day, and they were like, okay, so, you know, all these people are going to read this book, and like, they're going to know that like, this is about them. And I was like, oh my God.
Oh God. Yeah. I didn't even consider that when it came.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, so there's all of that. And then there's all the stuff about me and like, you know, what my parents are going to read and what they're going to think. I mean, it's not like a scandalous tell-all, but it is my life, right?
Yeah.
And it is my experience, and it's my story. And there is something really fucking terrifying about that.
Yeah.
But I think, like you said, there's something really powerful about that as well. There's something really important about, you know, just releasing the things that have happened to you that have been hard and scary and terrifying and amazing, and, you know, releasing them into the world and owning them in a different way.
Not worried about anyone popping up like Prince Harry did after he released his memoirs.
Yeah, I'm hoping no one, I'm hoping no one sees me yet.
So as someone who's achieved so much already, what are your aspirations for your future, both like personally and professionally?
I spend a lot of time thinking about like how I can go to the gym.
Okay.
And like if there's time for me to do that.
It sounds small, but taking time for yourself is really important.
Well, I never actually get to the gym, so I'm still working on that. Spend a lot of time thinking about why I don't have enough time to get my nails done. Time is like the general theme. I would love to have more time for myself. And I think that that probably involves, you know, really thinking about where I want to put my energy and being really focused about, okay, where does work end and where does Rebecca start? And, you know, I think I hear all the time, especially young female founders, and like you were saying earlier, that kind of hustle culture in London, and people are always talking about, like, you know, it's such hard work and like I'm so busy. And I think the fact that what I do and what I've done is hard is like the least interesting thing about it. And I just can't like stress enough how desperately I don't want to talk about how I'm so busy, or, and I just hate hearing people talk about that. Like, yeah, it's hard. Of course it is. Of course it's hard.
Sometimes being busy isn't being productive though.
Completely.
Like you could be running around that hamster wheel for ages, but actually never get anywhere.
Yeah. And I hear it from my family, you know, and it really makes me sad when they're like, oh, we know you're so busy, you know? And I'm like, I don't want you to think that I'm too busy to see you or to spend time with you, or that this is more important than the other things that I have to work on in my life, right? Like it's all work, relationships are work, and they're as valuable and as equally important as the work that I do, you know, day to day.
Yeah. And especially when your job is pouring into so many other people's cups, you can't do it if your cup's empty yourself.
Oh, completely, completely. And I think, yeah, anyone who like yourself is kind of running around spinning 1,000 different plates, right? Like it's exhausting.
It is.
But you can't let that suck you under. And I think that can't be the focus. So it's how do you kind of create a balance that makes sense for you?
That's something I'm still learning, like every single day.
I don't think it exists. I think that you just have to integrate well and figure it out as you go.
That's good, because that's pretty much the approach I take to all of my life.
Yeah, I think
just wing it.
Work-life balance is such a fallacy. And that isn't to say that you should be running 1,000 miles an hour all the time. But, you know, I think one of my friends said to me the other day, I like to think of life in terms of chapters. And maybe this is a chapter of hard work and the next one's a chapter of rest.
On a yacht in the Bahamas.
Amen.
With painted nails.
And Leonardo DiCaprio.
Minus the headphones. Please leave them at home. I'm going to be thinking about that in my sleep now.
What does Leonardo DiCaprio I'm so sorry for you.
I always ask my guests a similar final question.
Okay.
So what piece of advice would you offer to your younger self based on your life and career journey so far?
Oh, God. Just chill out. just chill out. I think I really, when I was younger, felt so often like I had to prove people wrong. And I've got to this point in my career now where, you know, I've done all of these things and there's a kind of level of respect, I think, that comes with that. And I wish that, you know, I knew that the only person I kind of had to prove anything to was myself.
Yeah, no, that's a really good piece of advice. I think that a lot of people, I can relate to that when you're constantly in like trying to prove someone wrong, but then you actually, what satisfaction do you get from that?
Completely.
If you're not happy within yourself.
Yeah. And happiness, I think that's a lifelong journey, but I think being present and kind of, you know, not thinking too much about what other people think is a good start.
Oh no, that's a really good piece of advice. Thank you. Do you know what you speak? You're such a calm talker. And I feel like it's made me change my tone of how I talk. I'm such a loud person. And I didn't realize how loud I was until we started talking. I was like, oh my God, am I really this bad? Now I get what my teachers were talking about.
Just shouting.
Yeah, I don't actually know where the volume dial is in my brain. That's something I'm going to have to work on for the rest of my life, I think.
You know, I think I don't know if my team would say that I'm very scary, but I think not shouting, there's quite a lot of like power in. Like when I tell people off and I'm just speaking in a very kind of even keel, then I go, oh my God.
I think that's worse.
Oh, I think it's way worse. My dad used to do it. I think it's way worse.
It's like when it's like, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed. It really hits you a lot harder than like, I'd rather you just hate me. Just shout at me.
Just scream. Yeah, just scream.
But I'm always just shouting. But I don't mean to be.
We'll work on your work on your podcast volume.
I'll find it's all right, Luke can change my volume. just turn her down.
No, you're a seasoned professional. I think you've got it on lock.
Oh, thank you. But no, thank you so much for coming. And I can't wait to read your book when it comes out next year.
Thank you for having me. And please, I will send you a copy.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.